The universe's consciousness is coming alive because of consciousness in it. So if you would say that at 300 million years after the universe was a gas phase and it, all the structure was formed by this massive sound reverberating back and forth, it became something bigger, and it couldn't have had consciousness. This is not enough time. So there's a sort of a margin where the universe starts to make consciousness or make the chance of consciousness. Each consciousness comes into being and has these realizations, then the universe becomes more conscious, maybe. And so every little precious jewel of a thing like we are is valuable to it because it adds to the whole. If we're the only ones, you know, goodness. This is the one experiment, but we don't know that. If you feel as though your experiences are connecting you with other conscious beings who are going back and seeking those profound experiences of the universe, and you feel in your body, and this can happen to people, you feel in your body that something has entered you, and it's not human. That may be something else that is seeking the same thing as you are and somehow connected to you. So that bridge, when that happens, may be the universe putting another piece together, because the universe isn't sort of maybe not be a grand plan, it may be an emergent process. We see everywhere around us how everything is emerging right as we speak. You know, ponds, I guess we may have lost, no, we still got sound. Stuff bubbles up and emerges from the bottom. That's almost, there's no master plan. That's what we see all around us. We may believe otherwise, but evidence all around us is that there's no master plan. So the entire question of the universe becoming conscious is a bubbling up. It's like, what's going to happen out there? And I'm not here until something happens. It's like the playa. The playa is not a thing until the first person arrives and starts putting something in, and the next camp comes, and suddenly it becomes a conscious entity. So that's the idea. Very good question. That James Lovelock in the 70s proposed this theory where the planet was a single kind of synergistic feedback loop organism that kept the atmosphere for what its needs were. And I think that that's become more and more accepted. Then, in fact, well, here's a good example. Planets that form in early solar systems do not have little free O2 molecules, little free oxygen around. Just can't happen because oxygen reacts with everything. The only place it came from was living things, and those living things were scum, pond scum, basically, algal mats that were bubbling out this oxygen that suddenly we know from when you mine for gold and you see gold that's 2 billion years old, it's not black and oxidized. There was no oxygen in the atmosphere. You'd need a spacesuit if you went back that far. And so the organisms put that in. When they put that oxygen in, it went up like a rocket about 1.8 billion years ago, created what was called the oxygen holocaust, which created a crash in the organisms because it was a poison in the atmosphere. So that first enormous step of what does life do first? Well, it looks up and says, we've got to clean all the crap out of this air and put stuff in that gives us the future. And now they even believe that plate tectonics and the diving down of plates and the way that volcanoes happen, and certainly the way that precipitation goes off the continents, is all life-based, and life regulates it. And so that the entire thing, it's infused all fields of geology and, you know, biology and climatology. It's like, what's the life element? What's the life component? What is life contributing to making hurricanes or not making hurricanes? Or what is life contributing to getting rid of a wildly out of control organism on the earth called human beings? Is there kind of an autonomic response, an immune system response from the planet that will deal with us? Now, of course, it's called disease or our own stupidity. But it's probably true that, you know, this entire system, just like Burning Man or the way you maintain your own garden, it's a maintained environment, and everything is in this fantastic balance. Is it a single conscious entity? I don't know, because could you communicate with it? But certainly it's an entity with an intent, and that's survival of the whole unit. When a big asteroid comes in, even, you know, say the Triassic-Jurassic boundary that create a huge amount of disturbance and crap, well, the early organisms that lived 4 billion years ago said, oh, asteroid, no problem. We got vacuum cleaners. We can live in superheated water. Give this planet to us. We'll take care of it. Because we lived in an environment when this happened. So life is this universal preserver of its own environment, unless it's pushed too far, I guess.
Do you think that this fascination or fragmentation of the universe that was necessary for it to have its own reflective consciousness, do you think that we may or may not yet have reached the defining point where the fragmentization, like if there was a point where it started to fragment, would it keep fragmenting and keep fragmenting up to a certain point where it's reached enough to where, okay, now we have enough fragmentization or facetization to actually like disperse this light in such a way that it is reflected? And if that, do you believe such a cusp point would exist? And if so, have we come to such a point where the universe has stopped facetizing or fragmentizing itself and begun the turn back toward reflective consciousness? Or is that potentially what we're coming up to that everybody's so excited about in 7 years?
I think the question was, you know, is there sort of some kind of tipping point where suddenly, you know, the ships will arrive, or we'll get, well, our brains will be filled with visions of our fellow beings. And we all hope that to be happen. It's in our movies, in our books, and in our imagination. I have a feeling that we as a species, it's very much like Captain Kirk. Remember Captain Kirk and the lizard guy? And they're like trying to strangle each other. And then Kirk says, I'll never kill this guy. He's just got scales and he's way too strong. He just threw me down the mountainside. I got to make a bomb. So he goes and finds, oh, here's some sulfur. And here's, now, how did Kirk get this knowledge? But he did. So he makes his bomb, and he finds a pipe, and he puts rocks in, and he puts ash and sulfur, and he makes a gun. And then he blows this guy down. Like, you don't actually see any injuries, but the guy's knocked, you know, lizard stuff doesn't start coming out, but he's, like, obviously knocked down. And this is a very, very low special effects budget program in 1968. And so he's like, oh, I did it. But do I kill him? You know, and so he's got the big thing and he's going to go crunch down on the lizard guy, and the lizard guy is saying, what has happened? And Kirk says, wait a minute, he's intelligent. You know, he was certainly intelligent. He kind of whipped my ass. And he was smart and everything. And, you know, I just can't do it. What if, you know, what if this was his way of greeting us? You know, and you know, who knows? He was thinking something and he just couldn't do it. And so he throws the things down and says, that's it, we're both doomed, you know. And just sits down next to the guy, and the booming voice comes out, says, you have shown compassion. You will not, therefore, your ship and crew, who is above this planet, don't know where the heck you are because we're blocking the signals for this test. And the Earth and all of your Federation was going to be vacuumed up and eliminated because it seemed to have bad properties, but this test was successful. Therefore, you're at class Q. You know, you're in the entry level. We will not be wiped out. You know, so is it that? I mean, is it as funny, sort of strange as that? You know, I think that this just permeates. Will we be accepted? And when will it happen? I think what it comes down to, it's each individual person's life and the decisions that you make and what you choose to do with this precious time that you have to render vision, receive it, and share it determines how far you get. And maybe it's an individual journey as well as a personal journey. Maybe that tunnel that people see when they're dying is the place you're going that is the collective. It's hard to say. Some people say, well, it's DMT-induced. But DMT was made a long time ago to power the organism you became, so there's a real reason for it. So maybe it's your personal journey and it's a group journey. So it's heaven and hell or the place to go in the afterlife. I would say just try to maximize your presence here and try to have those experiences and those visionary experiences, and try to read about science and what the world is opening up and what they're seeing. Try to do more art. Try to just fill yourself all your life and be as much as you can be. And I think that's all we we would know how to do to be part of that. And I don't know that the great moment will come, or if it ever will, or if it's a great moment will happen to you personally at one point in your life, and you'll realize that the moment has happened. And for some people, I think it does. Or when you pass away, the moment happens.
At the end of your talk, you spoke of the peak spiritual moments that we should have more often discussed and talk about them. What advice or what techniques would you have for extending that flash, you know what I mean? For the meaning that brings in the focus is gone instantly. Yeah. How are you able to extend that moment without calling attention to it?
I think that for me, you can get these little flashes all day long. And thinking about them and analyzing them with the waking brain, the brain that worries about getting to your job and whatnot, definitely throws the water on it. You know, everyone's experienced this. It's like you can't start thinking about the unanswered email and expect that other thing to not amscray and get out of your head. So, in fact, what you have to do is these purging experiences where you eliminate your daily life and you let it all be blown away. And for some people, it's heroic doses. I don't really recommend that unless you're with a whole community and you really know what you're doing. For other people, it's extreme sports. You know, when you do that bungee jump and you're down there and that adrenaline has rushed, that has been a pulse that has blasted a whole bunch of you off. You're not thinking of anything else. You're totally excited, everything. What if you are doing art? What if you are making a painting and you decide, all I'm doing is this, I'm possessed by this. If you become possessed by anything, other than, you know, it's generally, I think, a positive thing. And then in those moments of your possession, you now have enough shielding to block out the busy, busy daily brain to go into that space. And maybe if you're Alex Gray, you're always, it's coming out through his hand into paint on the canvas, and he doesn't know how, but it's coming out. Maybe he doesn't see the picture in his head, but then he wakes up, and all of us wake up and like, wow, look what came out of this guy. Well, he probably didn't do his email that day. He didn't do too much email, and you couldn't know when you could reach him. So I think that that's really the secret, is become possessed, and therefore having the power and the permission of being possessed, block out the other stuff, and just give yourself that. Does that make sense?
It seems like you think that life at our level is maybe a very rare thing in the universe to evolve to the point that we're at. And I was wondering if you think that that's maybe somehow indicating that just as life evolved from a single cell, that maybe our little single planet has reached that special level, and maybe it's our destiny to get out there and seed all the other potentials.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think the question was, do you think it's our destiny, maybe even our duty, since we've reached the threshold, to go out and seed or acknowledge and search for other things that are reaching the threshold or have, or even if there's swimming little silvery worms, go and say hello to them and say, we hope you make it and maybe we'll help you. Here's a moon. Take it. Pay us later. You'll need it. It may be that other civilizations do that, that the greatest gift that they give to the whole process is to saying, civilizations tend to not make it. They tend to get tired. They tend to get confused. If we're a star-faring species or even faring psychically, we're going to go out and say, we're our ones that are going to come after us. We're going to give them everything we have. We're going to protect them physically. We're going to put elements there. We're going to give them visions because we may not make it. And it's our insurance policy to make sure that the great gift of consciousness and the renderer goes on. Because if you stop thinking about time as a line, and you realize that the access, that the universe never loses information, light and thought and everything propagates out, and it doesn't ever go into the trash. There's no shredder. It's all there. And if you stop thinking in terms of time, well, that was last yesterday's news, I can't get it, you're wrong. It's echoing out there somewhere. It's pulsating out there. It's all contained. And so those beings that may have come to consciousness and made a good intent on our behalf, and some people might call it God or something, they're out there. They may be gone. They may have lost everything. But their memory and their act is out there. And that maybe coming to full consciousness, like when a baby is born, a baby is the center of everything. Feed me, you know. If you pay attention to my baby brother, or my baby sister, I'll scream. I am the center of attention. Total selfishness, but total love that comes out of the baby. The old baby, the old infirm adult that's kind of lost all the life's things, and they're kind of on a trip. They may have Alzheimer's or whatever. They may be one of your parents. For brief moments, they are grateful. When you see these old parents, like, smiling, Ronald Reagan, you know, whether you liked him or not, when he was in the final stages of Alzheimer's, it didn't matter who came in to his house, or and they some would kid would come in, they'd bring a jar of jelly beans, and this was described by Nancy. He would look up with his most beatific smile, and so happy and grateful someone brought him a gift. And you can imagine, this man has had different parts in his life, but that man ended up in this incredible gratefulness, just pure gratefulness for the simplest thing, because everything else was gone. Terence McKenna, when he was on his deathbed, now Terence is a real head case. I'm not a love bug. You know, that's what I'm no love bug. But on his deathbed, he said two things. He said, everyone, keep breathing. Just keep breathing. Good advice. And the second thing he said was, it's all about love. My God, it's all about love. It's like Bowman in 2001 saying, my God, it's full of stars. Like, he had this revelation. It's the whole thing. And it wasn't the psychedelic community or his life. It's like everything is about love. So he became this grateful being, grateful for everything. And here he was, you know, getting ready to leave the world. So maybe the journey of any human life, any sentient or conscious or human, is to go from the me-centered, which gives you power. Me, me, me gives you power. I'm best artist, I'll be the best boxer. I mean, look at Muhammad Ali. Look at what he was like in 1964. You know, it's all about me. And because that expressed his body power and it allowed him to do what he did. And look at him now with advanced Parkinson's. He's this glowing being. I mean, no one can recognize that he's even the same. You know, and he's grateful for anything. And it just comes out of his eyes. This boxer that was his most pugnacious individual, this prideful individual, has become this being. So perhaps that's enlightenment. And there's nothing wrong with the me, me, me journey. We need that power as a species. And there's nothing wrong with the selfishness of the baby. But old people, you know, often when you do look at your aging parent, or you look at an old person, you see that the roomy eyes, and you know, it may be uncomfortable because what you're looking in is person who's actually reaching enlightenment, and it may be hard to figure it out because they have Alzheimer's, but they're actually in sort of an enlightenment. Why? Because they've dropped the baggage that you still have. Now you may have to talk simply and directly to them, but every once in a while you're getting a little nugget that comes out that, my God, this is a pure thought, and it's coming from my dad who I couldn't talk to for 25 years. Yes, because nature has started to cut that out. They got too tired of fighting and putting up the false front that they have, and they've become this wonderful being. So if you spend time with them and realize they're changed, maybe this is not as much of an illness, because people are living longer, our elderly are living longer. It's caused a big problem for our society in the next 25 years. But they are a chance too, because as they lived this unnormal age, they are a portal, and we shouldn't throw them away and shut them away. They're an actual portal to helping you reach that stage. They haven't lost their minds, they've become clearer. Yeah.
Just like
So what Galen is saying is that love and gratitude is the channel. I think we know this, right? If you spend all this time getting everything ready for Burning Man and whatever, and you come and something hasn't been done, you know, all of us have had mates and friends, and you know, that fifth person was added to the motorhome, Jesus, they fucked it all up. You know, the motorhome's too heavy, it's slipping down a hill, and there's ingratitude getting here. We get here, and there's a certain thing that blows off a little bit of that. But if you hold on to that ingratitude, or like, you forgot the aloe, you know, what if I get burned? You know, all those things. If you let go, you have to let go of that. Otherwise, you'll leave Burning Man having gotten nothing. So you finally say, okay, it doesn't matter we forgot. It doesn't matter this guy was noisy or didn't get sleep or whatever. You've got to be grateful. So if there's any one place in the world or in your lives in this hectic 365 days, if it's to be grateful, it's to sit out on the playa and let it go and let the playa energy and the people here blow that away. Let somebody who comes up to you and gives you a gift, and you don't think, what are you doing trying to take advantage of me? If you just say, no, it's a gift. Let that come in. Let the gratefulness come in, and then give them a smile. Look into their face, because you got very little chance to do this. And if you can do it here, you can elevate yourself a little bit every year and go back out into the world and be grateful. And you know, all of us know when we meet people who are profoundly grateful, like an aging parent or even a child that is extremely happy for getting the wrapping paper to play with and doesn't care about the gift, but the wrapping paper, now that's what a gift. You know, it's 2 years old. We see that gratitude. It makes us sort of uncomfortable. It makes us wistful. Why can't I be grateful? Well, people are around you are grateful, and they show that grateful, whether it's Reagan with Alzheimer's or your baby or, you know, your cat that is coming up to you and is incredibly grateful that you're at home. And gratefulness, and as Galen is saying, is that we had a lot of fights coming here. And I'm grateful she's here. And that's the channel probably which everything comes in. And there was a question here. There we are. Who influenced Douglas Adams' infinite improbability drive idea? Does anyone know? Because I don't. I love the idea that a spaceship can turn into a rose, and then can turn into, everyone can turn into a woven, you know, creatures made out of wool. It's kind of it's a great film. I don't know. And we're gonna way in the back. You can really shout. Boy, Kundalini Awakening, I love some of that right now. After having written 4 government proposals all summer. Spiritual emergencies, you mean in a sense of someone having a bad trip, or? I still don't understand. Psychotic, like attacks and stuff. Boy, I'll tell you, you know, it just happens to people. It can happen to people without having any kind of a trip. I mean, in a sense, it's the dark night of the soul, and one can read wonderful literature for thousands of years from Rumi to about the dark night when it comes. And in a sense, as we in our society always say, we want the high, we want the connection with oneness or with God. Well, that's an intensity that a human being gets. But I think every human being should have a dark night of the soul, whatever it is, because it plumbs the depths. And you get humbled by that. Now, if someone, I think, has a chemical imbalance that gives them depression, and constantly hammering, sometimes people that can't fight that alone. And that's one of the great things we've learned about, is that people who are chronic and are constantly in spiritual emergency sometimes need help. And we now know how to help them. And it's not their fault. And we're going to lose them if we don't help them. We know how to bring them to balance. And some of those people are our best artists. So we can't, but don't make them too cured, because they'll never get any art. But don't let them go and take their lives. You know, pull them back from that. It's a funny thing. And to tell you the truth, in hill tribe villages in New Guinea, there's a particular village. To give you an idea of, we think of these people as being, you know, not advanced. But in fact, they're incredibly advanced in a couple things. They have a crazy house. They have a house in the village reserved for when someone goes bonkers. Why does that person go bonkers in the New Guinea Hill Tribe? Because in the New Guinea Hill Tribe, if you think life is structured and strictured now, living in some of those societies, everything you do is given to you. Your role, everybody criticizes what you do. It's incredibly densely socially packed, and people go bonkers. They can't take it anymore, and they go to the crazy house. And the crazy house is different, because now we know we've got a crazy one. We don't want them to kill themselves because they're one of us. We're going to help them back and maybe learn from them why we're getting a little too... Why did they go crazy? They're the guinea pig. So maybe a lot of you out here are the crazy house people, and that this is a big crazy house for the planet. And you've been sent here because you can't take it anymore. You know, you can't take all the stuff you don't want to take. So you're all maybe on a bit of a spiritual emergency, but those, unless they're chemical and people are helpless, I think the spiritual emergencies are critical to everything human beings can do or should do. Do we have another? You got your second question, so this will be the last unless somebody just jumps up. Yeah, I think she's saying, is there like a dynamic flow between the dark spaces and the light spaces? And you're right, because nature, things that stop moving, if a river stops flowing, it becomes stagnant and things can't live in it. And rivers go through rapids and they become scary places where things die and then they become beautiful lakes. And everything's always on the move from one thing to another and back. And it could be cycles, could be seen as cycles, as Eric Davis was saying. So if you're not moving, if you're saying, I'm perfect, I'm 100% or 99%, you know the kind of people that say, I'm just every day fantastic. They're not allowing themselves to move. They don't communicate that I'm in trouble or I feel terrible or whatever. They don't communicate that. They're just right on. Or I'm depressed. They're always the same. No human beings, that's stagnation. That's death. That's gradual asphyxiation. Everybody has ups and downs. In this audience today, I was kind of sensing the ups and downs when people would get a little tired or distracted, and then a wind would blow, or there would be an art car coming outside, and like this would rustle, and everybody would change and shift. So there was points where everyone was like, for whatever we were saying, and then there were periods where it was lightened up. You could see all in your faces. So you're on this time wave, and you can't keep yourself in the good times all the time. You just can't. It's not natural. You're not living. You will die. So I hope that... I'm saying go with the flow and don't try to, I wouldn't try to fight it. I would just say it's great. But if you're going the flow and the negative and you think that's the permanent, know that, the greatest shamans in Europe, the traveling soothsayers would go around these European villages, and there was a thunder, they would see a thunderstorm gathering over the village, and they knew it was going to be a long one. Then they would go into the village and they would start saying, whoa, is everyone, the huge storm is coming, the earth is going to be taken away. And of course the thunderstorm was pretty severe and people were gathering to them, and we'll give you food, will you save us, will you give us advice, etc. And then the shaman sort of keeps his eye on the weather and sees a star poking out in the middle of the night and says, and lo, by the dawn there will be beauty again, and you will have your lives back and your children will be found. And of course it was. And then people were exalted the shaman, and he took off. But he was kind of doing the job of, if he stayed a lot around and said, now I'm your priest and you have to build me a temple, and he's sort of taking advantage of them. But often these shaman would just move on. So they would bring these people through the darkness, and then they would come and bring them into the light, and they would magnify the experience for them, explain it to them. So those poor people in New Orleans, what those people are going through, it's awful because they don't have any guide at all. People are shooting each other inside that stadium. People are killing each other in the stadium. They're shooting all over the grandstands. People are being raped. There's an entire old age pension home in that stadium, which has part of the roof off. And a old lady just, like we just read on the, another old lady just expired in her wheelchair. There's nobody there. There's like 30,000 people there. There's no services. And so those people, and you know, put your mind and your heart out to them. And they're all people of color. And if the people aren't of color, they're old, infirm, southern, southern white from old age home. That's all I've seen. And they're trying to save each other, and they're trying to, they're just going down and down and down. And they think they've been abandoned. So they're going through this town. They hear explosions. A huge chemical depot just blew up this morning in another part of the city, and there's fires. People are torching buildings. The National Guard's coming in with M16s because there's a lot of sniper fire. Just snipers are firing at helicopters. Why? These people are not quote-unquote terrorists, and I never use that word. I think it's a stupid word you should never use. But people are firing at the helicopters. They're angry. And why did you take out someone else? And why did we get left here? And you're coming in, and you guys, the National Guard are coming in, and they're putting their guns are at the ready because some of them just returned from Iraq, and that's all they know. It's an urban situation. Someone's going to shoot at us. Get armed and get ready. So when they come down that helicopter on that roof, they're coming out with those weapons. So what message does that send? So the United States is about to enter a bit of a dark night of the soul on this one, because we have really failed. And those there may be a very hard way to get forgiveness for this. And hour by hour, it's getting worse and worse down there. And I work with NASA, and at the NASA facility, the Stennis facility in Mississippi, there's 1,000 people living in the building where they fix the shuttle main engines, and that are running out of food. They're just living there because everything south of Interstate 10 is destroyed. All the homes are gone. And so this is not a small thing that's happening. So I would ask that everybody at Burning Man try to picture that and try to picture the consequence, because you're about to leave the playa and enter the media mayhem around what's going on down in the south and what's now taking over the country. There's anger, all kinds of stuff are going on, but it's an opportunity to breach the barriers of the divided nation that we live in and say, you know what, we just got to help people. We've got to do something meaningful. People are getting ready to go on buses down there. It's very hard to get into the city. Our camp contacted an admiral at the Pentagon that we work with, who's like a very open thinking admiral named Lynn Wells. And we said, this was John Graham and Dave Warner, said, if you land helicopters, military helicopters at Black Rock Airport, we have a complete Wi-Fi setup. We're in the nerd camp that does the Wi-Fi generators. Everything's set up. We will load it onto the helicopters and fly us straight to Louisiana. We will set it up. We will go from rooftop to rooftop, and we'll put, dust and tubs and the repeaters and tubs are all self-powered. You can see the towers all over. Those are our towers from our camp. And we will set up on the rooftops of Louisiana. We will be not carrying weapons on the rooftops. We will drop SIP cell phones to 10,000 people. Say, here, the cell phone, call in. Tell us what you need. We can't pick you up, but we need to know what is going on. My uncle's trapped in the attic and he's going to die. He's been there for 3 days and we can hear him pounding on the ceiling, because they're sitting on the roof. We need an axe. So suddenly it could be coordinated. But our government is highly incompetent in doing this stuff. And the chains of command and whatever, the citizens have to be able to do it. So that proposal was sent in yesterday, and we're waiting for, and I think Lynn has come back and said, we need you. I don't know if you're going to hear Huey's going whap, whap, whap out of the airport. If you do, they're evacuating a bunch of people to New Orleans. So it's a dark night of the soul for America. We thought it would be with Iraq, but that's kind of over there. Nature has said, okay, you people, Bande Aceh, Iraq, it's all the same thing. It's all about people in need. How much do you care really about people in need? And we're bringing this to your shore. So it's interesting. So just like 9/11 happened after the burning of the magnificent first temple in 2001, where it looked like burning buildings, and the 9/11 happened a week later, and we said, we just saw a burning building at Burning Man. What does that mean? Ask yourself what Burning Man means now, that you're going out into a nation that is meeting a dark night. So, I think.